Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Wednesday that Russia had not lost anything as a result of its military campaign in Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials remain guarded over how their military's counteroffensive in the country's south is faring, but they have reported steady success in the Kherson region.
Plus, Britain's new prime minister not only faces challenges abroad, but at home. And later in the program,
every child we speak to talks about still having a lot of fears, you know, that keep them up at night, just not knowing what the future holds. And, you know, that doesn't go away quickly.
A new report says that up to 4 preschools in Ukraine are destroyed each day because of the war. Today is Wednesday, September 7th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations chief and the International Atomic Energy Agency on Tuesday called for fighting to be halted in a security zone around Europe's biggest nuclear power station, which is located in Russian-controlled territory along the front lines. Reuters' Jillian Kitchener starts us off.
With ongoing shelling near Europe's biggest nuclear power plant sparking widespread concern of a pending disaster, the UN nuclear watchdog on Tuesday called for the fighting to stop and for a security zone to be established at the plant, located in Russian-controlled territory along the front line of its war with Ukraine.
We are playing with fire, and something very, very catastrophic could take place.
The Zaporizhia nuclear plant, seized by Russia shortly after its invasion of Ukraine, is controlled by Russian forces, but run by Ukrainian technicians. Russia and Ukraine each accuse the other of shelling. Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, spoke at the United Nations on Tuesday following a report by the IAEA that called the situation unsustainable. He and other IAEA inspectors braved shelling to cross the front line and reach the power station last week.
The hits that this facility has received and that I could personally see and assess together with my experts is simply unacceptable.
Grossi said a security zone should be established immediately around the plant, something also urged by United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres.
An agreement on a demilitarized perimeter should be secured. Specifically, that would include a commitment by Russian forces to withdraw all military personnel and equipment from that perimeter, and the commitment by Ukrainian forces not to move into it.
Inspectors said they had found Russian troops and equipment at the plant, including military vehicles parked in turbine halls. Moscow has denied accusations that it used the plant as a shield for its forces, but says it has troops guarding it.
Reuters reporter Jillian Kitchener. On Wednesday, Ukrainian officials said that they are looking at the option of shutting down its Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant for safety reasons. They are worried about the reserves of diesel fuel used for backup generators. The acting head of Ukraine's State Nuclear Regulatory Inspectorate, Oleg Korokov, said during a news briefing, if the situation at the plant deteriorated and forced it to use external energy sources like diesel fuel, that could present a problem. He says that maintaining the safety equipment requires roughly 4 diesel tanks a day, but bringing in that amount of fuel through the front lines is very difficult, and there could potentially be a situation where there won't be any diesel fuel at the power plant. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday said that Russia hadn't lost anything as a result of its military campaign in Ukraine. His comments come as Ukrainian officials say that they have had steady success in a counteroffensive in the country's south. Reuters reporter Luisa Nex takes it from here.
Russia is gaining, not losing, from the conflict in Ukraine, according to President Vladimir Putin, because it is putting Russia on a new path to restore its global clout.
I am sure that we have not lost anything and will not lose anything. I want to say again, it is often said, I can see, which is absolutely right. We didn't start anything in terms of military actions. We are only trying to put an end to them.
Putin was speaking at the Eastern Economic Forum in the Russian city of Vladivostok. He did, however, acknowledge that the conflict had unleashed a, quote, certain polarization in both the world and in Russia. For civilians in Kharkiv, which was hit by shelling on Wednesday, there are no gains, only losses. This woman showed Reuters what remained of the sewing workshop where she used to work. Everything is ruined, she said. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials remain guarded over how their military's counter-offensive in the country's south is faring, but they have reported steady success in the Kherson region. A video released on social media on Monday was said to show a Ukrainian soldier raising his country's flag in Visokopilia, located in the Kherson region, that had reportedly been retaken by Ukrainian forces. Reuters was not able to verify the date the video was filmed. Russia says it has repelled an assault in the south and has not reported any territorial losses. However, an official with the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, which is pro-Moscow, said there was fighting in Balaklia, a town located between Kharkiv and Russian-held Izyum, adding that if the town were lost, Russian forces in Izyum would become vulnerable. Reuters was unable to independently verify any battlefield reports.
Louisa Nax of Reuters News. Russian President Putin also threatened to cut off energy supplies if price caps were imposed on Russia's oil and gas exports, warning the West it would be frozen like a wolf's tail in a famous Russian fairy tale. The group of seven wealthy democracies announced plans to impose a price cap on Russian oil exports last week in a move that could also restrict Russia's ability to secure tankers and insurance from countries beyond the G7. EU energy ministers are scheduled to hold an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss how to tackle the energy crisis. The Commission will also put forward other measures, including a mandatory cut in electricity use during peak hours and a cap on the revenues of energy generated from other sources. In addition, Putin raised the possibility the UN-brokered grain deal could unravel if it cannot be successfully renegotiated and it may not be renewed by Moscow when it expires in late November. And for additional updates throughout the day, be sure to visit our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. In Britain, Liz Truss officially became the Prime Minister on Tuesday, replacing Boris Johnson, who resigned in June. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, Truss is seen as a foreign policy hawk and has pledged a tough line against both Russia and China, but she first faces daunting challenges at home.
Changeover day in Britain, a country rarely short on ceremony and tradition. Outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson met Queen Elizabeth II Tuesday to offer his resignation at her Scotland residence. The 96-year-old monarch is unable to travel to London because of health problems. Just a few hours later, Liz Truss made the same journey and was asked by the Queen to form a new government. She is the 15th Prime Minister to be appointed by Elizabeth. Truss flew back to London and gave a televised address.
We now face severe global headwinds caused by Russia's appalling war in Ukraine and the aftermath of COVID. United with our allies, we will stand up for freedom and democracy around the world.
Any political honeymoon will likely be short-lived, says John Kampfner of Chatham House.
90% of her time is going to have to be dealing with the here and now on the domestic agenda, with an economy in crisis, strikes, health service, huge energy bills, potential for social unrest.
Despite a promise to cut taxes, it's reported that Truss will spend up to $150 billion on freezing energy bills. She has pledged to boost defence spending to 3% of GDP, estimated to cost $180 billion. Meanwhile, she has pledged to continue giving military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed her appointment. In Ukraine, we know her well, he said in a video posted online. She was always on the enlightened side of European politics. I believe that together we will be able to do much more for the protection of our nations and to ensure the failure of Russia's destructive efforts, he said. As a government minister, Truss took a hawkish stance on China. Neil Melvin is from the Royal United Services Institute.
So China will be recognised under her premiership, she's indicated, as a threat to the UK.
Truss has also pledged to tear up a key Brexit agreement that Johnson signed with the European Union over Northern Ireland. Again, John Kampfner of Chatham House.
The worst case scenario is a full-blooded trade war between, can you imagine, between the 27 European nations and Britain. In every respect, that will be a disaster. It will add fuel onto the fire of an already pretty terrible UK economy.
President Biden congratulated Truss on Twitter, saying he looked forward to deepening the special relationship with Britain. Again, John Kampfner of Chatham House.
But the Americans, and particularly the Biden administration, are incredibly wary of having to choose between the Brits and the European Union. They regard it as a false choice.
Analysts say rarely has a new prime minister faced so many headwinds on taking office. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Save the Children estimates that 4 preschools are destroyed each day in Ukraine. Sonia Kush is the country director for Save the Children. Now, I caught up with her over Skype just the other day after she returned from the field. And that's where we begin our conversation.
Well, today I spent the day in Bucha, which is a little bit north of Kyiv, looking at some of the programs that Save the Children is supporting. We support families with cash assistance to help them, you know, just recover and rebuild their lives after going through pretty horrific experiences, but we're also rebuilding a big school in Bucha. Well, we're helping to repair it. And this school had been occupied by the Russian army for about a month, and we were able to see still some of the effects of the military occupation. Almost 100% broken windows, smashing of doors, destruction of all the IT equipment, you know, laptops and printers. Anything that was valuable was taken. It was really sad to see that a place that had, that normally brings so much joy to, you know, children and their teachers, had been so sort of callously treated and destroyed to this degree. So while schools are open in Ukraine now as of September, that school is certainly not ready. So we're supporting the community to fix it up, and hopefully it will be ready in a couple of weeks for education again.
And I guess it goes beyond just the need for repair for these facilities, because Save the Children, your organization, by your own estimates, there are some 4 preschools a day that are being destroyed because of the fighting. And I guess when you factor in the large number of internally displaced people because of the fighting, even more so when you include the number of people who have opted to leave the country completely and become refugees, I guess the question I have for you is what is the impact? Can you help us understand the context of the loss of these facilities for those who are remaining in Ukraine?
Yeah, you know, schools are still being used by militaries. You know, they're being occupied and they're still being destroyed. So, you know, the school I was at today was in Bucha, which is, you know, close to Kyiv, and there's no active fighting there, but there still is active fighting in the eastern southern part of the country. And so we're really concerned that schools continue to be destroyed and there are still ongoing displacements of families out of the east, you know, who are still arriving in Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine seeking safety and shelter. So when you disrupt the whole, you know, education system, you're really putting children so far behind, you know, on the heels of 2 years of COVID and not being able to get, you know, the ideal education. Now we're facing another year of a lot of online learning, and it's really destructive to children's education, but also their mental health. You know, a lot of them are being separated from their peers, their teachers, you know, their fathers. Every child we speak to talks about still having a lot of fears, you know, that keep them up at night, just not knowing what the future holds. And, you know, that doesn't go away quickly. We do what we can to support, but some of the effects of those, if they're not treated, can be long lasting, even into adulthood.
Can you expand upon that? Because you really brought up a very good point. Because, I mean, there are several areas of the country that are still actively engaged in conflict that aren't too far away from civilian centers. And as you know, school is now back in session, and the kids who are attending these schools are facing a wide range of issues, mental health issues, post-traumatic stress, and really fears for survival as the fighting continues around them. And because of the way that Ukraine has opted to restart the school year, meaning that if it's safe, you can go back in the classroom, but if you're closer to where it is not safe, if there's fighting in the vicinity, you're going to go online. I guess, you know, what are some of the key developmental issues that are at play here? Because in many ways, kids are struggling to grasp what's going on, to feel safe, and to be in a position where they can really satisfy that lowest level on Maslow's hierarchy of needs to feel safe so they can develop naturally, especially if they're close to an area where some of their educational facilities have been destroyed.
Yeah, it's really affecting children, you know, the level of uncertainty here. Just to give you, you know, one story, today I met a family with three girls ranging from, say, 8 to 16. So the youngest girl said her greatest wish is to go swimming because she missed it this summer. The 12-year-old said she just wants the shooting and the shelling to stop. And the 16-year-old girl said she wants, you know, more activities to have, you know, some social outlets with her friends because they're always cooped up indoors. So you can see there's a lot of just unmet needs here that are facing children. And it's been really challenging to get them the support they need because it's not only the children that are affected, their parents are affected, their teachers are affected. We get a lot of requests for mental health support for teachers because they will struggle to provide support to children while they're still suffering themselves. And then you have the parents who just want to protect their children at all costs. So even in places where school buildings are open because they have shelters, parents are too nervous to send their children into a school building. So they're holding them back and teaching them at home. That then makes life more difficult for parents because they can't go out and work as easily. So then they don't have an income. So you see there's so many, you know, sort of knock-on effects of the conflict, you know, stemming from what are, you know, mental health impacts, but then the effects of it stretch all the way into, you know, economic impact for families and communities.
Unfortunately, many analysts do not believe that there's going to be an end to the conflict anytime soon. So moving forward, what do you see as some of the key issues that need to be addressed, not only in the short term, but the long term?
Well, right now, in terms of just humanitarian needs, I mean, Ukraine being such a well-developed country and, you know, the markets here are still working, basically getting cash into people's hands is probably the best solution because then you're giving them the opportunity to be able to do repairs to their home, which is where a lot of the cash goes to, or to buy food or just to take, you know, to rebuild their lives in an area if their current home is destroyed. So cash assistance has been so critical in this particular response. And a country like Ukraine, being advanced as it is, can really absorb that kind of response, which is great. And it's much easier actually to deliver cash rather than bringing in a lot of supplies. But that's really, you know, the first phase of the response. Then you really need to look at bigger programs to fix shelters so that people can return and stay home where it's safe. You need to look at rebuilding schools. You know, we estimate, based on what we've heard, that more than 2,000 schools have been damaged. You know, rebuild clinics, all that sort of rebuilding that needs to happen is going to be critical if Ukraine is really going to, you know, get back on its feet again for the longer term. But at the end of the day, obviously, the main thing that needs to happen is that the conflict needs to stop, right? All of those would be short-term measures in the absence of a conflict that continues. So we're really calling on the priority for the warring parties to stop.
And what else do you think we should keep our eye on since you're there on the ground?
Well, I think the only thing I would stress is the sort of the mental health impacts of this cannot be underestimated. Every person we talk to, whether it's a parent or a child or a teacher or a doctor, is really struggling with sort of the impacts of living in an active conflict. And so it's so important that resources go to address those and that these effects don't linger into adulthood, especially for the kids. Because based on our experience working in conflict zones, if it does linger, it's really problematic. You know, when you let toxic stress build up in a child's body, it can actually affect them even physically all the way into adulthood. And we don't want to see that happen here.
Sonia Kush is the country director for Save the Children. And I'm speaking to her via Skype in Kyiv, Ukraine. Sonia, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Russia's invasion has affected several aspects of life in Ukraine. Maxim Moskalkov reports on the effect the war has had on the adoption of children.
According to the U.S. State Department, in 2020, Americans adopted more than 200 children from Ukraine. Ryan Hanlon, CEO and president of the National Council for Adoption, says in that same year, Ukrainian children made up more than 10% of all kids adopted by Americans.
These were children that were older and often had lived many years in an orphanage setting before being matched with a family approved by Ukraine's government. The family would go to court in Ukraine, finalize the adoption, and then travel home after the U.S. government had also approved it. When the war broke out, of course, travel was halted.
According to a number of U.S. adoption agencies, when the war started, more than 200 families were at different stages of the adoption process. About 100 of those families ended up in adoption limbo.
Many of those children had already been hosted by U.S. families. Now those children, these families are pursuing an adoption. Those children might be in refugee camps. They're in settings that aren't, of course, ideal.
Phil and Christy Graves got lucky. They were supposed to learn on February 25th when they could take their adoptive daughter Bridget home. On February 24th, Russia invaded Ukraine. The Graves waited for 6 long weeks before finally picking Bridget up from Lviv.
There's a big part of you that wants to, like, push the Ukrainian government. Let me just come get my kid. Let me just come get my kid. But at the same time, there's, you know, you understand they're fighting for their freedom and their, you know, for their lives, and you don't want to bug them about adoption.
Gina Callahan and her husband agreed they would adopt 8-year-old Sveta back in 2019 after her second trip to the U.S. as part of the hosting program. But in 2020, COVID-19 made proceeding with adoption difficult. On February 22, 2022, the family finally got the green light.
The day we got our approval, we were so excited. It was so much work. And finally, we got the answer we were hoping for. But that same day, Russia started evacuating their embassy in Ukraine. And my husband and I looked at each other and we're like, this is not going in a good direction. Like, that's a really bad sign. So now we're in a waiting game.
Like many other prospective adoptive American parents who found themselves in a similar situation, Gina is encouraging the U.S. and Ukrainian governments to allow families to host the children temporarily during the war and resume legal proceedings when the war ends. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage in Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.